I'll take the chair's prerogative of asking the first question. This is to Dr. Ferris. It turns out in my in New Mexico, we have a pediatric group and an adult group that we actually work quite well together, and we've been interested, particularly with a young faculty member, in starting a transitional care clinic. It turns out it wasn't just me or this new faculty member, but every leap year we revisit this notion of having a transitional care clinic only for our efforts to fall short. One of the people had records every 4 years. We keep trying to reinitiate this clinic. And the issue where it gets hung up is arguing for resources from the administration, right? Because when they look at the number of patients, 40 patients, they laugh when we ask for any effort or any resources. So, Dr. Ferris or others, can you help me make the argument that we to get more resources?
So thank you for the question. When we started this work, we've been at this for 9 years now, and I started with a grant, actually. I started a grant from RRI, and we started to collect evidence that transition preparation works, and it decreases admissions, and it decreases comorbidities. And so now, at about year 2.5, we convinced the solid organ transplant administrator, which is the division that has the more money, at least, in except for neonatology and intensive care. So we told them that this transition is an issue of quality improvement, patient safety. I showed the data of the mortality, the morbidity, and those were the magic words, quality improvement, patient safety. And they have funded us. So for the last 6 years or so, our main coordinator is funded by the institution. Mm-hmm. She is the main part in the budget. I don't have to leave off of grants. Mm-hmm. Now, what I have done with her, Christy Bickford, who's been with us for 9 years, and the one that taught me all they need is love, and that's why I put that name. I honor her work. She is a resource for the nurses and nurse practitioners and physicians and everybody in the hospital. So we have a hospital-wide program. But this is how it started. It started with one seed money from RRI, and then we just expanded. Other institutions are taking our lead and following that advice.
Thank you for that answer. All right. Front right for me, please.
Tokir Karim, I have a question for Tim. Thank you for your very interesting presentation on the pediatric population. So I'm just curious to know about PKD. You don't see it in the pediatric population because it's underdiagnosed. They don't really come until they're late in their 30s or 40s. So, you know, it's highly prevalent. It's about 12 million people worldwide and more than 12,000 ESRD patients here, 2 out of 10 patients on dialysis. So knowing when you follow up, if there is a family history, you think you could apply non-therapeutic measures to slow down the cystogenesis?
One of the dictums that occurs within the pediatric nephrology experience is that if you have a parent with polycystic and those in its dominant form, and they have 4 children, we know the statistics. We know that 3 out of 4 are going to be there. When we get what the standard across the country is, if a pediatrician Al calls and says, should that child get an ultrasound, the answer is adamantly no. They should get a blood pressure only. Despite the viewpoint of our federal government, once that patient is diagnosed as a chronic kidney failure patient, they are now uninsurable. So we actually are big advocates of blood pressure, weight control, dietary, and that's the best thing to do for those patients, and trying to avoid making that diagnosis until we have a better healthcare system in our country.
Yeah, that's the challenge, because, you know, these cysts, they grow from the size of hair follicle, and they keep growing.
Right.
So there's a lot of work being done, so, you know, so those are the challenges.
It is, I think, until, you know, the data with rapamycin that was out about a decade ago is very interesting, looking at cyst, lack of cyst progression. And knowing there's some side effects. But I think until we deal with healthcare costs, I think that's really important. So blood pressure is something that is an advocate among our population, that probably the most important screening that we can do for them.
Thank you.
Back right.
John A.J., Long Island University, New York. Dr. Tim, you had mentioned earlier how nutrition is very vital for children with CKD to support growth and development. My question is, what nutrition therapy would you provide a child who has CKD and also has irritable bowel syndrome, which as a result is not able to meet his or her nutritional needs to support growth and development.
It's interesting you asked that. I was making notes to myself for suggestions to Peter for next year's meeting, and I think nutrition and CKD would be a fascinating discussion, both for internal medicine and for pediatrics. If you look at the population we deal with from 0 to 18 or 0 to 21, the source of nutrition changes dramatically. So in the children less than 2 years of age, most of the nutrition is liquid-based, and as you get older, most of the nutrition is solid-based. It is not unusual that many children with congenital renal disease with chronic renal failure have some sort of feeding tube placed early in life as a alternative to early dialysis as a way to enhance nutrition, enhance growth. But you're actually pointing out really a problem that we see clinically all the time. How do you balance what often are high-fat, maybe high hyperosmolar formulas, the usual cast of characters, Nepro, renal calciplena, for pediatrics, PM6040 that could be put in various forms with a balance of an irritable bowel? The answer is it's trial and error. We work a lot with our GI colleagues, and we have a number of patients with CKD, with IBD, that actually we really have to adjust as we need to. Additive, if you have a portogen-based or a MCT-based formula, often that actually is better for some of the patients with inflammatory bowel disease. Often there's a high potassium load. One can either Renovell or K-Exalate that formula, I can talk about that offline sometime, to diminish the phosphorus and the potassium load in that formula prior to giving it to the patient. It goes back to literature about 1991 that actually shows you how you can chelate out some of the cations in order to avoid the potassium load in those patients. But it is a trial and error, and it's something that I think we all are struck with. The mistake that gets made, though, is TPN. TPN is is an individual morbidity in these patients between Lyme sepsis as well as all sorts of downstream complications. So we will do anything we can avoid due to TPN in these patients.
Thank you.
Thank you. Front left.
Hello. My name is Ana Catalina. I'm from the Children's Hospital in Mexico City. And my question goes to all the presenters. Congratulations for your lectures. I'm very impressed with Judy's life story. And yesterday I told her that probably we need something like that video in Spanish or with a translation for our patients to encourage them to continue with their lives. But the things, and this goes with the comment, with your comment, is in terms of resources, I'm thinking that I can see my children from our hemodialysis unit, that those adolescents probably will see your video, and probably they will say, well, that's United States, they have money, and they can do that. How can I do this? Because in terms of structure, things, everything, we don't have those resources. And I think that mainly the problem is that our government, at least in the pediatric nephrology field, are not conscious about how many patients are with chronic kidney disease. So I'm probably here, I'm just talking about Mexico, but all our underdeveloped countries have this problem, I'm pretty sure, and it's sad. I know that it's sad. So maybe we can start with a register, with an epidemiological inform that we can learn from you and make bridges, because we have different societies. We have probably, in terms of health, we have the same problems with the adolescents, drugs, sex, with all of these acute issues. But in terms of society, I have a lot of patients really worry about to go to the adult hospital because probably they will not reach the treatment. So it's sad, but it's not impossible. I really think that if we have the effort all together, we can find the bridges to adapt the programs to our society, because definitely we cannot ask to all the world give us money, because this is not magic, I know. But I think that is not impossible, so I don't know if you have any opinion or experience. I know that you are working with Africa, and it is hard work that you are doing, and I'm really touched about that. But I think that we are different societies, and maybe we can find a way to help our people, not only, well, I'm talking for the children's, but for the children, I'm sorry, but even adults, because it's really hard for them to reach this kind of therapies. So, thank you.
Thank you.
So the Pierre Kushat, who unfortunately could not be here, is actually currently on an airplane, who's the head of IPNA. IPNA, for the adult nephrologists, is our ISN equivalent. There is a big push with World Kidney Day coming up in March about, again, advocating this. And so I think, to me, as a society, we need to ask the question, what can we do other than dialysis to take care of patients with chronic renal failure? Dialysis is the expensive part, and it's in many places throughout the world, it's unattainable because of the cost of that. So we need to look back, as the gentleman who was asking, nutrition, some of the other comorbidities of uric acid disease, of things along blood pressure control. I think there's many other things. Often in many countries like Africa, China, India, it's actually basic medical care that actually is more important than chronic renal failure. They're dying of unimmunized patients and patients related to bad water. So I think it is very individual from country to country. But we need to look at alternatives other than the dialysis. I think that's the best way to look at this.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Back right.
Only one question, but I must give two thanks in particular to all. One to Judy Weintraub for really a spiritual raising, or at least raising my spirits, of your personal experience. And now that I'm 30 years into it, to know that I could still have another 10 years with a few more really good, not just outcomes, good things to do, because it's a pretty down era. And then to Dr. O'Hare for returning us back to clinical teaching and clinical guidelines. I mean, clinical teaching and experience for both nephrology training and for continuing medical education, because we've so lost that. And with that, I'll go my question, which is a very simple one, but it's in the same back to the future thing. There's a lot of words there about albuminuria and proteinuria, a lot more about albuminuria. And yet, I'd like to return... ask a question about returning to balance those two together, because they're not the same, and there's more. I see so many urine microalbumins referred to me without even a urinalysis. They have non-albumin proteinuria has implications as well, though it's the minority, but it is actually in the older women. So could the group that keeps using the word albuminuria only, because in evidence-based medicine, I don't think they've compared them and said that the one is more predictive or better than the other. And I think O'Malley's very recent English presentation demonstrated that.
So I guess the question is, so just to clarify, the differences between sort of proteinuria and albuminuria as far as outcomes, and what is the best way forward clinically to assess this?
Or no, I albuminuria is said to measure glomerular damage, but it's only true when the tubule can't reabsorb it. Non-albumin proteinuria is a separate marker, and the pediatrics talk about tubule interstitial disease. It's a lot more non-albumin proteinuria. Albuminuria is just more sensitive, and our primary care, and I think even nephrology fellows are now missing the in-between, whether it's whether it's light chain Benz-Jones, other disease there and quantification.
Got it. So I guess the issue is, when we focus solely on albuminuria, are we missing other nuances, right?
And we are. A smaller segment.
Okay. Does anyone want to take that up?
Well, I think it's a really good point. And, you know, I'm not sure quite the history. The current guidelines focus on albuminuria, and I think that's largely reflects what's been available to study. I know some of our work in the VA healthcare system, we find if we just use albuminuria on its own, we're confined to looking at people with diabetes because that tends to be the population that's ascertained in. And we've actually used things like dipstick proteinuria, which again, of course, is mostly albuminuria. But my sense is that you raise a very interesting question that I haven't seen. You know, I may be missing some literature here, but I haven't seen that explored fully. I think it would be very interesting. My sense is it's probably to do with a little bit to do with convenience in terms of what's been available to study. But I do, you know, there are some ongoing studies such as CRIC that are collecting both things. I think that it's a fascinating question.
We have a urinalysis lab. We do our own urines where I practice. And we most recently, so we do both the albumin stick, you know, the dipstick, but we also have sulfosilic acid. And we use it really on all our UAs to see whether there's non-albumin proteinuria. So we do screen for globulins or light chains. And what's become difficult is that it's very hard to purchase it and in solution. So you actually have to buy powder and make a solution of it. When I was a fellow, we had bottles and bottles of it. So I don't know whether there's lack of recognition a long time ago. Lack of recognition, but I agree with you that that's really part of comprehensive care to see whether, if there's no albumin, are there light chains in the urine, I think, and that's important.
Just a brief comment on the use of the dipstick. I mean, when it comes to really defining the very high risk of progression of kidney disease, maybe the dipstick is good enough, especially if you're in a low resource setting. Because that's what makes a difference. When you look at lower levels, the impact is higher on cardiovascular than in kidney disease.
Are we left?
I'd like the panel to comment on this idea of the tyranny of these guidelines. I've been practicing nephrology for over 30 years, and one of the things I worry about is this year half of the positions for fellowships in nephrology didn't match. I think we've got a lot of young trainees coming into this. The stress in older physicians are seeing a lot of people take hospitalist jobs because nephrology is too hard. Part of that, I think, comes from this tyranny. The greatest pleasures of mine in nephrology have been individualizing care for patients, and our hands are really becoming tied. Most of us now are employees of hospitals. We are paid sometimes and reimbursed based on guidelines. I can tell you I have to meet every year now and talk about whether I wash my hands. Turns out I'm a bad hand washer. I've been instructed. If the patient doesn't see you do it, it's something that didn't get done. You can go through the CQI that we go through at Fresenius. You can say, I remember I had many patients who felt much better with a hemoglobin of 12. I know there were big studies that said maybe in populations it doesn't matter, but a lot of individual patients felt better. We're gavaging patients with protein. We learned this morning that maybe that's not a good idea. Blood pressure, we really don't know. For a while, we said 160 was great for people over 80. Now, everybody in the country is going to be trying to get everybody to 120. We're going to have more broken hips. We could go on about this breast cancer screening guidelines, et cetera. I think we're also being told that patient-focused care is now one of the mandates of the ACA, so it's almost contradictory. So I guess what I'm... Fresenius has a big footprint, and maybe we shouldn't come out of the CQI going back to patients, say you absolutely can't have a catheter, you absolutely have to eat more protein. Maybe that could be something they could take on as a thing. How can we do this for the 200,000 patients that they take care of? But I'd be interested in the panel's ideas about how do we turn that into action? How do we do this in our units and make our job easier for our young trainees coming into this?
Step right up, panel, for that simple question.
It's my first comment was get rid of the MOCs, but that's my own bias. You're absolutely correct. In the pediatric arena, it's not unusual that the first conversation starts out, well, the protocol says this, the algorithm says this. And when you're a bit of gray hair and your mustache, the first comment was, stop. How does that patient fit into that protocol? And I think we are, with no offense to the fellows in the room, we're at risk for allowing the fellows to be trained based on computer algorithms and forget that each patient is an individual and each patient has unique needs. And I hear exactly what you're saying. I'm a big advocate with the RASPN, which is just saying we have to quit doing evidence-based if it's not intuitive or if it's not, or if it's in conflict with what we need to do. But then you become the lone wolf in that discussion. So I agree with you. FMC is a good example of a great organization that actually has a great advocacy. And maybe we need to deploy industry to help us with this. Just an idea.
No, I think you came up with some interesting ideas yourself. One thing I kept thinking about as you were talking was an article I read in the New York Times a couple of weeks ago about some hospitalists in the Portland, Oregon area who were actually unionizing against their health system because of these exact concerns. They felt almost cheapened by some of the financial incentives that were being offered to them in terms of performance targets. And they felt that it was not only leading to bad patient care, but it was also eroding their self-esteem as physicians. And I think there is a groundswell of sort of support for, essentially our right to take care of our patients in the best way that we think possible. So I think it does have to come, it is going to have to come from us, but it would be wonderful if there are organizations that are supportive of that, for sure.
From right?
I have two questions, if you don't mind. The first question is concerning evidence-based medicine. You know, we collect, data from the published literature for performing systematic review meta-analysis. The challenge there is, whatever results you are pooling in the data, you do critical appraisal, and then, you come up with your statistics, whether it favors or not. You don't get to see the unpublished evidence, the results with the bad, they don't come out. So there's a lot of publication bias mm-hmm. there. Mm-hmm. So, and that leads to false interpretation. So what are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think I would agree with you that there's definitely selection in terms of what gets published, but I think there's also other kinds of selection even in terms of what is the published literature. For example, what we decide to study, how we decide to study it, what outcomes we select. Many times in our field, the outcomes are mortality and progression to end-stage renal disease. When you're evaluating that literature, you have to think about, well, are those the outcomes that matter to my patient right now? Maybe they do, maybe they don't. So I think that you're absolutely right. There's the literature we can't see. But even in the literature we can see, there are biases, and it's not always clear what the source of those biases are. And especially... many of the articles that are published in very high impact journals can have a very powerful impact on practice. So it is critical that we, think about how relevant those findings are to our patients in applying them.
Thank you.
I have a follow up to that. We're participating with the National Kidney Foundation and American Society of Nephrology. I'm sure other people are as well. To bring medical residents who are interested in nephrology to our national meeting so that they can really, observe the goings-on and perhaps interest them into actually becoming fellows because, again, 120 matched positions went unfilled even after the scramble. So when they went to the latest American Society of Nephrology, they went to the late-breaking clinical trials, and they were all negative. Every single study that they talked about was a supposedly randomized clinical trial, well-designed, crossover, control. They were all negative. And so when we met with them afterward, they said, what's up with nephrology? There's not one positive study. There's not one thing that we have to look forward to. I mean, it's all these large studies of or 150 patients with glomerular disease, which is not representative of the general population. So I think we've done this to ourselves in that, we've really moved away from the principles of really, what are we doing? We're really there to serve our patients. And we've really fallen into the trap that, you know, if there's not a randomized clinical trial of 20,000 patients that has shown that a blood pressure of 122 over 91, which we can't even hear or measure, it is really what we need to aspire to. So I agree. I think that, you know, we're our own worst enemy, and that we have to really go back to really patient-centered care, and the groundswell really does have to come from us in a real big lobby. And I don't, you know, it's beyond my, but, you know, I don't know if Dr. Katanko here and Fresenius can take that on. It seems like a daunting task, but we have to start somewhere.
I guess if I could just take the chair's prerogative and grab the last question, and then feel free to come up afterwards. I guess my question goes to Ms. Weintraub. To me, I don't have a degree in psychology or anything, but it was interesting that a lot of your dialysis experience was self-care, right? And as someone who is in charge of a number of units and the staffing of those units, both MD and non-MD, I was wondering if you could advise me as a clinician and what your experiences are with as a patient and to, like, how to interact with techs, nurses, others positively in order to promote your own care. Because I can tell you, you know, there are a number of places where it's very hard to find not only nephrology fellows, but nephrology, like dialysis technicians or nurses. And sometimes you have to satisfy and just get someone. So how could I engage these people to provide better care? What was your secret?
You know, I'm sitting here and listening to all of the speakers on the panel this afternoon, and it's so thought-provoking. Each and every one of you bring up issues that are so vital to this field. Things that pop out at me are planned starts versus unplanned starts of treatment. Mine was a planned start, I think back, and I really resisted that, but it turned out to be extremely important for how things would go. Another, you hit it on the button when you observe that 25 of my 40 years of dialysis have been some type of self-care. This is what I'm thinking of. I'd like to throw this out. What was the other part of your question? Interaction with the nurses and technicians?
Yep.
Was that a struggle for me, or was that welcome that I wanted to do self-care?
So how would you deal with a technician that you didn't trust or like? How could you engage them to provide better care for you?
Okay. I have been extremely fortunate during my journey that there have always been one or two nurses or technicians to help me do what I needed to do along the way. I have met with a lot of resistance. And I'm listening to how important nutrition is and albumin level. My albumin level is currently 4.2, which when I bring it up, it's like unheard of. Why? Why does it need to be unheard of? What is going on in the field that an albumin of 4.2 is considered out of reach? And so I'm thinking of all of these different factors, and I'm trying to connect the dots in my head. And I think excellent nutrition, for me, the gateway to excellent nutrition is clearly some form of home dialysis, whether it be PD or home hemo. What is the biggest roadblock? In the talk I gave yesterday, the nurses who were at the meeting identified placing your own needles as a huge resistance to going into home hemo. For me, what happened was, in the early days of my dialysis career, I was only 16. Second access was troublesome. It was multiple infiltrations, a lot of clots, and it was torture, okay? And I was in a pediatric unit at the time in New York, Albert Einstein. And so I was in hospital. I see the surgeons coming down the hall. They want to talk to me about putting a graft in my arm. And I looked at them and I said, I always had an eye to the long term. I said, I have two arms and I have two legs. Well, you're saying basically we're using up two arms. What do I have left? I don't know where it came from. I said, teach me how to put in the needles. That, I think, is a key. So what I'm going to bring up as a challenge to each and every one of you is turn the whole field on its head and think about doing self-cannulation as the default. When people cannot do it for one reason or another, okay. But I'm putting it out there for you to think about considering self-cannulation as a default mode, because for me, I learned when I was 16. And so all the years I was in center, I put in my own needles. Then I went to PD, and my fistula placed in 1975 continued to work for those 12 years. And then when it was time for me, after transplant number 3 was a no-go, that I said to myself, home hemo is the way to go. And I already had the beautiful skill of knowing how to place my needles. It is a huge roadblock mentally for people and a big barrier, I believe, to going to home hemo. So if we turn the field and say, okay, here's what you got, here's what you got to do, this is the way to go. Something I hear about home hemo advantages being flexibility in schedule in terms of patient perspective. What the heck happened to improvement in health? I don't hear that a lot. For the doctors here, you know that that's obvious. It's improved health. But for some reason, that's not getting communicated. But again, I'm just thinking about placing your own needles being considered one of the early pushes when someone initiates treatment. I'll end with one more thing. I taught deaf children, preschoolers, and their parents for many years. I had a boss who, when he would gather a group of parents who were brokenhearted, that they had children from infancy to age 4 that were profoundly deaf, he would face these groups and say, your dreams have been broken, and you're here to rebuild those dreams, and we're going to help you rebuild those dreams. There's something in there that's applicable to the world of kidney disease. I think all the people here are armed and have the tools to help people rebuild their dreams.
On that note, thank you all.